Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
Happy Thanksgiving and welcome to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about a Wisconsin baseball player who our guest says may have been the unluckiest player in the history of the sport. First, we're just hours away from major retailers opening up their doors to Thanksgiving Day shoppers looking to get a jump on Black Friday. Actually, one retailer has been open since 6 this morning. Plans to stay open until 11 tomorrow, a total span of 41 hours. It's a growing trend among retail stores, but not everyone is happy about it, including our next guest, who says the best thing you can do is just stay home. I'm joined now by Ellen Galinsky. She's the co-founder and president of the Families and Work Institute. She wrote a piece for Time called Don't Go Shopping on Thanksgiving, Just Don't. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So why shouldn't stores be opening their doors on Thanksgiving?
I think the issue is not all stores or all services. There are emergency services we need. There are some people who need to go out to eat on Thanksgiving. There are people who want to go to the movies as a family on Thanksgiving. So I think the point that I was making was starting your Christmas shopping or your holiday shopping early. That seems to me to be much more discretionary than things that you do for family fun or emergency services that you may need.
So it's optional, not mandatory or holiday-based. So, but stores are saying, hey, there are people who want to shop here. We don't want to turn away money coming in the doors. Why shouldn't they open on Thursday?
This article that I posted on Time Inc. has been the top-running article for the for the 5-6 days since it's been posted, and has more than 100 comments, and I've read the comments, and most people seem to feel that the issue is one of choice, that the particular issue is that some people are forced to work and don't really want to work on Thanksgiving. If you get bonuses or special pay, that's one thing, but a lot of stores that are opening don't seem to be doing that, according to the responses that I've gotten. The thing that I feel, though, is a larger issue, which is that the way we work best is to have some time for rest and recovery, some time away from work, and we have an image of work right now as running a marathon. Just run, 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 never stop. Well, if you're training for a marathon, you take time for rest and recovery so that you can run all those in the New York Marathon, 26, 27 miles. And we don't have, with technology and with the way we're working these days, we don't have time off. And our data show that people are not working very well when they're just always on. So having time for other things in your life, whether it's family, whether it's creating traditions with your children, whether it's with friends, whatever it is that you do that gives you a break seems to be important. And we, little by little, work is spilling over and taking up most of our time. We find that the people who have some time off, a vacation day, holidays, and vacations are people are taking much less time and they're wrapping around weekends. But the people who have time off have much better health, sleep better, are more creative at work, make fewer mistakes at work. So I'm arguing that we step back and look at the way work is spilling over into our home life. This is more about the workers than about the shoppers.
So it sounds like you're saying that's not having that time off, whether it's Thanksgiving or vacations, isn't just bad for the workers. It sounds like you're saying that it might be bad for the employers, too, if the workers are coming in bad shape because they have no time off.
It is bad for the employers because people tend to blow up, you know, get angry at work. If they have had no time off, they tend to make mistakes. They tend not to be as creative and innovative and engaged. So, yes, it is not good for employers. And workload is an issue that has been on the agenda. We did our first study on overwork in 2003 and have done other ones over the years. We find about a third of employees feel seriously overworked with no time to step back and think about what they're doing, overwhelmed by everything that they have to do. And it's been like the elephant in the room. Employers haven't begun to grapple with it because they can't imagine, like the stores that are opening, being productive unless they're open all the, you know, unless they're asking people to work all the time everywhere. And what this year, we give an award for excellence in employer flexibility and effectiveness through the Sloan Foundation, the Sloan Award for excellence in workplace effectiveness and flexibility. It's called this year. Among our almost 300 winners, we had about 10% who were actually beginning to tackle the issue of workload by looking at who's never taking any time off and encouraging them to, by cross-training so that all the people don't have to do the same job, by giving people choices, by that sort of thing. So, finally, employers are beginning to recognize that overwork isn't good for them.
So by this time, obviously, stores have long since made their decision on whether to be open on Thanksgiving Day. Your message today, I'm guessing, is to consumers. What do you want them to be thinking about as they're deciding if and when to go shopping?
Think about how this will feel in 5 years. What kind of Thanksgiving do you want to have? On the emails to people, some people are saying, I want to go shopping. That's my idea of a holiday.
But it's not mine.
But my view, not mine either. My view is that think back, particularly if you're going to be with friends or families or do something. What kind of traditions, what will you remember about this day in 5 years, and vote with your feet.
And not go shopping.
Not go shopping.
So, but if I'm a brick and mortar retailer, I'm saying, you know, Amazon isn't shutting down today. They never close their doors. The things that are really threatening my business are going to keep running, and maybe people just stay home and shop online. I've got to compete with that somehow, and maybe that means asking my workers to make a sacrifice and come in on a holiday.
Well, that's interesting because you've got different brick-and-mortar retailers behaving in different ways. Costco is one that has always paid higher wages, that has been more flexible, has been much more of an employer-friendly kind of a business. And their business is doing well versus some of the businesses that are falling into this work all the time everywhere sort of notion. So what I'm saying to all of us is let's step back and think about how work is affecting our lives off the job. And it can enhance our lives off the job, but if we're just completely worn out, it's not going to be good for our personal life, and it's not going to be good for our employers.
Seems like this Thanksgiving Day shopping has been on the rise for the last few years, really. Do you think we've hit a turnaround point where we won't see more stores opening on Thanksgiving and maybe some will be rolling it back?
I'm not. If the business isn't very good, that will speak for itself. I mean, we know that work is ever encroaching on our lives, and people may think it's a small thing, but who would have thought that professionals would be working nights and weekends a long time ago, and look how that turned out.
All right, Ellen, thank you so much, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Have a wonderful time.
Ellen Galinsky is the co-founder and president of the Families and Work Institute. Her piece, Don't Go Shopping on Thanksgiving, is on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up next, we'll hear about a Wisconsin baseball player who barely missed playing in the World Series on 4 separate occasions. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday would have been the 93rd birthday of Johnny Schmitz. If you remember Johnny Schmitz, it's likely you were either a Chicago Cubs fan or a resident of Wausau, Wisconsin. In his day, Schmitz was a pitching phenomenon, according to our guest, Gerald Poder, professor of American Studies at Lawrence University. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Good to be on.
So Johnny Schmitz, he was born in Wausau in 1910, made it into the big leagues at 18. How unusual was that for the time?
That was pretty unusual. Actually, he was born in 1920. He's from Wausau, born in 1920. And he made his debut at the age of 18 for the Cubs, and actually went on to have a pretty solid major league career. His nickname was Bear Tracks, and the reason for that is that his feet were huge. He wasn't necessarily a very tall man, but yeah, I guess sometimes people of average height have huge feet. And he took a photograph when he was young, sort of with his spikes up in the air, like, you know, leaning on something. And someone said, "My God, you've got these huge feet. They're like bear tracks." And so his nickname was Bear Tracks throughout his major league career.
I guess you could do worse for a nickname.
Oh, now, well, in baseball, you can do much worse.
Yeah. Now, I gather he batted right, pitched left, also a little out of the ordinary?
Very, very out of the ordinary. I can only think of a couple of major leaguers who batted right-handed and threw left-handed, whether they were pitchers or outfielders. That testifies to some ambidexterity, I think, in his genetic makeup, because that is very, very rare.
He enlisted in the military during World War II. His career started in 1938, so like almost everyone else, he went to war. How did that affect his career when he came back?
Well, Johnny Schmitz, unfortunately, I have to say, is one of the most luckless Major League Baseball players perhaps in the history of the game. And I say that because he managed to miss out on playing in the World Series a number of times, actually four separate times, and the first time was because he was in the military. He was in the military between 1943 and 1945, and he was Cubs property, the last pennant that the Chicago Cubs won, as many Cubs fans or all Cubs fans know, is 1945. So Schmitz, who got back to the majors with the Cubs in 46, missed out on playing in the World Series in 1945 because of his military service.
So that's one missed World Series. How did he miss other ones?
Here are the others, and they're really excruciating. He toils with the Cubs until 1951, and the Cubs are a very bad team by the late 40s. But in 1951, he gets a huge break. He's traded to the Brooklyn Dodgers, who were in first place in 1951. And once again, it looks like Schmitz is going to play in the World Series. But as it turns out, the Dodgers, who had a 13.5-game lead in August in 1951 to the Giants, ended up losing that lead, tying on the last day of the pennant race in 1951. Two out of three game playoff. They lose the first, they win the second, or they're tied 1-1 in games going to the third game. The Dodgers are up 4-1 in the bottom of the ninth to the Giants in the third and final playoff game, and they lose on Bobby Thompson's famous home run. And Schmitz is in the Dodgers' dugout. Having been liberated from the Cubs, he thinks he's going to the World Series, but no, Bobby Thompson in the last inning, after his team has lost a 13.5-game lead, and he's not going to the World Series. However, there's still time for him. There's still an opportunity for him, and it comes the next year. He is still with the Dodgers in 1952, so had he stayed with the Dodgers, who won the pennant in 1952, he would have gone to the World Series. But no, he's sold to another team, so he misses out with the Dodgers. But the team that he gets sold to, I'm not making this up, is the Yankees. So
right, sure
he has
thing
yet another
there.
Opportunity to be in the World Series, and in fact, the Yankees in 1952 went on to win the World Series. But no, in September of 52, he gets traded from the Yankees to the Reds, so he misses out on the World Series again. But there's still hope. There's still one more opportunity, because in the offseason of 52-53, Schmitz gets reacquired by the Yankees. So Once again, maybe he's going to the World Series, but no. In the 53 season, a season that the Yankees would win the World Series, he's put on waivers and claimed by the Washington Senators in 1953, a team as far from the World Series as you can possibly be, and he never gets to the World Series.
But he was a good pitcher, though, right?
He was a good pitcher on bad teams, and that's sort of almost like a term of art. He made the All-Star team twice in 46 and 48. He led the league in strikeouts 1 year in 46, and that's, you know, that's a pretty impressive achievement with all the great pitchers coming back from the war that, you know, that he was a strikeout leader. In those days, there weren't huge strikeout numbers. His strikeout number to lead the league, I think, was in the 130s. So it's not like, you know, he struck out 300 batters, but, you know, he did lead the league, and he was a very solid, dependable starter for the Cubs, unfortunately, on bad Cubs teams.
Wow, almost like he was cursed to never make it to the World Series.
I think he was cursed like the Cubs. I think he was cursed like the Cubs. In fact, in many ways, he symbolically represents, I think, the futility of the Chicago Cubs in, you know, during that time and afterwards.
So he retires in, I think, the late 50s. What did he do for the next half century?
Well, you know, he was a good Wisconsin boy, you know, born and raised in Wausau, and that's where he came back to after his career ended. He was a groundskeeper at a golf course and basically kept a very low profile until he died only 2 years ago. By all reports, he was, you know, again, very typical of Wisconsin, a very modest man, an unassuming man. Certainly, you know, he played briefly in New York for the Dodgers and Yankees, but he was not a New York kind of personality.
And he ends up, and how did this happen, in a painting by Norman Rockwell?
In a painting by Norman Rockwell. And you know, again, if you're a Cubs fan, this is almost the symbol of futility. Norman Rockwell decides in 1948 that he wants to do a baseball painting. And Rockwell lives in New England, so he heads to Boston, where the Cubs are playing a doubleheader with the Boston Braves, then Boston Braves. And what Rockwell would do is he would pose people before the game or pose people preliminarily, take photographs and work from that. And he ends up painting four Chicago Cubs and a bat boy in what became a famous painting, and maybe some of our listeners have seen it. It's called The Dugout, and it shows four forlorn Chicago Cubs sort of staring out on the field, and just to the right, in the sort of the right-hand corner of the painting, is Johnny Schmitz. The others are the manager, Charlie Grimm, Bob Rush, and Rube Walker, and they're just sort of staring out forlornly at the field. And I think even then, only 3 years removed from their pennant in 1945, Rockwell understood that the Cubs were almost like a cursed franchise, and Schmitz, I think Schmitz symbolized that. And actually, in the game, there was a doubleheader that day. It was in May 1948, and after Rockwell set the paintings up, the Cubs went out and lost both games of the doubleheader, and one of the players in the painting, Rube Walker, was hit in the head by a ball.
Wow. So did that painting end up becoming a symbol for Cubs fans over the years?
I think it is. Scott Simon, who is an NPR essayist is known for basically linking that painting. I think it hangs in his office, I think he said. linking that painting with the futility of the Cubs, and there really is a sad sack quality to this painting. The fans are booing them. It's a road, you know, it's the Boston crowd, so they're booing them, and they look like awful things are happening to them. And if I were a Cubs fan and I was looking to symbolize or encapsulate the futility of that team over decades and decades, you can't do any better than this Norman Rockwell in the dugout painting.
Back to Wausau. Does the city of Wausau look at Johnny Schmitz as a local legend?
Very definitely. And again, I think that he goes back to Warsaw. He doesn't big time it. You know, just as politicians get what we call Potomac fever and refuse to go home to their districts after their careers end and they stay in Washington, many players end up living in, you know, the more glamorous cities that they played in. Schmitz wasn't like that. He ended his career and there was no question where he was going to go. He was going to go back to Warsaw, where he grew up, where he lived, where he knew everyone. And he was, I think, a bit of a local legend for all these years. But he lived for over a half century after he retired. But he wasn't, again, he wasn't the kind of guy to try to draw attention to himself. So he lived pretty quietly. I think he was the kind of person, if you wanted to talk to him about baseball, he would talk to you, but he wouldn't sort of strut into, you know, stores or taverns and say, "I'm Johnny Schmitz." Mm.
All right, Gerald, thank you so much for sharing a story with us today.
My pleasure.
Gerald Podair is a professor of American Studies at Lawrence University. If you have a suggestion for a Wisconsin legend, someone from Wisconsin you'd like to hear more about, call our hotline, 855-683-5422. Coming up on tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to an expert photographer about his tips on making better pictures. He'll teach us how to really connect with what we're taking pictures of. We'll also talk to an author who imagines what it would be like if mayors ruled the world, and we'll get our weekly roundup of the top news stories from around the state with Michael Leland. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Still to come on this Thanksgiving edition of Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says it's time to hold a national town hall on football and related injuries. I'm Rob Ferret, flying solo today. Veronica Rickard is off. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's hard to imagine Thanksgiving without cranberries, unless you're like Nadia Van Vicken, born and raised on a cranberry marsh. Nadia and her husband own the Weatherby Cranberry Company in Warrens, Wisconsin. She's the third generation to work the marsh. WPR's Maureen McCollum brought us her story.
Well, I've been involved with cranberries my entire life. Born and raised on the marsh. My grandfather was the first foreman on the marsh. And my mother lived on this marsh all but 2 weeks of her life. Passed away this past May 4th, but she was 96 years old. And I credit all of her healthy nature to eating lots of cranberries. I tell everybody, that's why she lived so long. She ate all those wonderful cranberries. I was kind of a tomboy when I was growing up, and I would be right behind my grandfather's footsteps. If he turned around too quickly, he probably stepped on me. And I learned a lot of things that I still use in the cranberry business from what he taught me. Moisture of the soil and counting the berries on an upright to see what your productivity level was, and just really simple things, but they still hold true today. In the early 30s and 40s, the berries were all hand-raked. They were curved teeth that would comb through the vines, and it is a slow process. We had a cranberry sorting device called the cranberry mill. The berry enters the top of the mill, and if it's a good firm berry, it's going to bounce over the 7 wooden barriers and roll onto a sorting table. If the berry never bounced, it went straight through the mill down into wooden slush boxes, which were your discards. And then in those years, we had ladies that sat on each side of the sorting table doing the final hand sorting of the fruit. We have a very short window of time to get all of our work done for sorting and packing. I came back to the marsh in 1973. I'm an only child. I thought, well, you know, take over the marsh and whatever. Well, it didn't take me long to realize that a single woman, it was difficult to run an entire cranberry marsh. So I was very fortunate and found Jim, who had farm background, farmers have good work ethics. And 39 years later, we're still happily married on a cranberry marsh and enjoying every minute of it. And we do have four children, three girls and a boy. They help in some manner all during the year, and they all live close by. I know I will never be an empty nester. I'm very pleased that, you know, my family is interested in it and we can work side by side on the marsh. I think it gets into your blood and you never want to leave the area. It really does.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org. Our next guest says America is in a state of denial when it comes to football. He says what we need now is a national town hall meeting on the game to collectively address the health problems football creates. Joining us now is Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director at League of Fans. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So the documentaries I mentioned, United States of Football, League of Denial, two documentaries that tried to shine some light on concussions in football. Were they successful? Did they get us talking?
Well, I think there's generally a little more awareness across the country on the issue of brain trauma in general and concussions in particular in football, but it hasn't moved from awareness to understanding to attitude change and behavior change. I think it's back to business as usual and all the way down to the little leagues, which is pretty dangerous in my mind.
It's your sense that people maybe saw the documentary or heard about it, said, oh, that's a shame, that's too bad, and then went back to watching, coaching, participating as they always did.
Well, we're in a unique situation here because there's little doubt that football is America's favorite sport, and there's also little doubt today that football is hazardous to the human brain. So the issue is, how can we reconcile those two facts, and can they be reconciled? And I think at the very least, we need to have a serious discussion about football for our kids, because kids' brains are even more vulnerable than adults. They're still developing, and the risks are even higher.
What do we know about the impact of football and the impact of these injuries on young people in the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of research out there. Just one thing that I'll throw out is that in any given season of high school football, 20% of the players sustain a brain injury. And even scarier than that is because these schools don't have trainers and doctors to the degree that college and NFL teams do, that 40.5% of these high school athletes who suffer concussions return to action prematurely. And that's really dangerous because then you can get second impact syndrome, which can shut down the brain, basically, and sometimes result in death.
You know, I don't know. I know there's peewee football. How young are kids starting playing tackle football?
6 or 7 years old. And one of the deals with the kids that young is if you go watch one of the games, it's kind of cute because they're not going that fast and it looks like they're kind of just hugging each other. But in reality, the brain impact, in fact, there was a study done that showed the G-forces from peewee football are very similar to adults. So
really?
It's dangerous. Yeah, even at that young a level when they're not hitting each other that hard, they're still suffering a lot of damage.
Well, and then there's the idea, or probably the fact, that kids' brains are still growing and developing and therefore more vulnerable. Is that part of why you want to start focusing on this younger level?
Well, yeah, that plus the fact that there's over 3 million kids playing youth football and over 1 million kids playing high school football. So the numbers are just humongous relative to the number of people playing college and NFL football. So I think the fact that we have that many kids playing football and the fact that their brains are more vulnerable as they're developing and their necks aren't as strong, which leads to more of the whiplash effect, that we definitely need to shift the focus to the younger kids.
Well, before we get to how you want to change that focus, there is the argument that, you know, there are positives of football. The teamwork, the exercise, camaraderie. Yes, there are some risks, but the positives outweigh those negatives. How would you answer that?
Well, I think those are legitimate positives. And just to clarify, I played 6 years of football myself. My dad was a football coach. I still enjoy watching the game, although it's harder knowing what's going on with inside their skulls. But I'm not anti-sports at all. I'm just looking at something that is real here, just like when we were looking at smoking in high schools, you know, and we banned that. I think the same thing needs to be discussed. Well, what are we going to do with football in our youth? And what's troubling to me is the research I've looked at is there's no magic bullet out there. There's not a helmet that can be designed that's going to protect our brains, because helmets were designed to protect skull fractures, and they do a good job with that. But in terms of the brain, it's like Jell-O inside of a bowl, and when you get hit, whether it's in the head directly or even in the chest, it's a whiplash effect, and the brain smashes against the side of the skull, and that's what actually causes the concussion. So there's not a helmet that's going to protect that brain from smashing against the side of the skull.
You recently wrote that we need a national town hall meeting to talk about the issues you're raising here. What would that look like? What are you hoping it could accomplish?
Well, as we started this conversation, there are some great documentaries out. There's been some articles written. People are more aware, but it stops there. It's like we're really in a state of denial. We just go back to how things were. I think what we need is a national town hall, and I think ideally ESPN would be the host of that. It could be sponsored by the Pro League, NFL, and other football organizations. And it's not just football. It's other sports that are dealing with this too.
So what would success look like to you in terms of this national town hall meeting or changing the conversation? What kind of changes on the ground, on the football field for kids would you like to see?
Well, I think the conversation, the town hall, would include medical doctors and researchers, youth sports organizers, all the way up to the NFL. So we get a well-rounded panel discussion going. But I think ultimately, in my view, what's got to happen is we got to have much less contact in practices. You can limit tackling and blocking and things like that. Even the NFL's gone to very limited contact during the week. A big thing is that there's got to be strict return to play guidelines. If there's any sign of a concussion at all, the kid needs to be pulled out and sent to a doctor and cleared by a doctor before they can go back into action.
Thanks to Ken Reed for joining us. He's Sports Policy Director at League of Fans, a sports reform project aimed at encouraging social and civic responsibility in the sports industry. This is Central Time. Thanksgiving is a holiday dedicated in large part to food, but how often do we think about where our food comes from? On this Turkey Day, we're focusing on community gardens. Our next guest says these gardens aren't just about the end result, the food, but rather the cultural connections people have with cultivating the land and growing crops. And she says it's important to look to the past and understand the often troubled relationship between race and agriculture. Our guest is Venus Williams. She's the director of Alice's Garden. She wrote a piece for Edible Milwaukee called Preserving the Culture in Urban Agriculture. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Venus, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what you think a community garden should be, the potential. What are some of the functions they should be fulfilling outside of the food itself?
Community gardens have an opportunity to bring people together whose paths may never cross in an urban area. So the growing of food, I always say, is the carrot, pun intended, to get people to come into a garden to explore who their neighbors are, to explore what kind of food and food traditions others in the community and in the city have, and to really address multiple issues related to health and food and culture.
And you say in your piece that a community garden, an urban garden in a place like Milwaukee shouldn't, again, just be about the food. It should look at the history of the people's relationships to food and in some cases the tales of struggle and injustice related to growing food. Can you talk about what you're looking for there?
Sure. As an African American, my relationship to food is very different than a European American. My relationship in this country to food and land is one that is burdened with historical trauma. It's burdened with stories of slavery and sharecropping, so that many people, when they arrive in urban areas, I have heard it often said, I will never grow anything again, because they still have memories of growing up in the South, memories of working land that maybe did not belong to their parents or their grandparents, working land where there still were so many injustices happening on that piece of land. And so part of my task is to help people unpack that baggage related to food and to reclaim the growing of food in a healthy, healing way.
Well, that's really interesting. Coming from that perspective, why the heck would you garden? That's something that people were escaping from, this agricultural work that was seen as that was oppressive in the past.
Right. Well, if you have control over what you eat, you have control over who you are. Many of our issues related to health and wellness are all about what we consume. And so by not growing your own food, you're handing over power to others, no matter who you are, no matter what your historical relationship is with land and food. So my opinion is everyone needs to be growing something that they eat because everyone has to eat. So when you couple it with the historical connections with land and food, whether you're speaking of it from the African-American perspective, whether you're talking about it from a Hmong refugee perspective, we all need to heal our relationship with land and food.
Well, let's talk about how this works on the ground and tell us how you do these things and confront these issues at Alice's Garden.
One of my favorite Alice's Garden stories is related to when we reconfigured the space, and there were people who had been gardening for a decade, and they were gardening in monolithic communities. So the Hmong farmers were all gardening together, and the few African-American gardeners who were there at that time at Alice's Garden were gardening together. When I mixed them up and put them next to one another, it was a challenge because people, no matter who you are, always used to things being the way that they are. Folks don't want to change. But what has happened because of placing people who were not growing food next to one another, to folks from different parts of the country, different parts of the world, the exchange of ideologies, the exchange of agrarian traditions, the exchange of gardening know-how really came to life, and people really started getting to know not just the food that other folks were growing, but why they grew them and who these people are. In Milwaukee, we have had many bridges to cross related especially to Hmong farmers and the African-American community. And one of the things that we're very intentional about at Alice's Garden is building that bridge of understanding between the Hmong and the African-American community.
You must hear some great conversations. What do you hear in that back and forth between, say, the Hmong gardeners there and the African-American gardeners?
The conversations that happen very often, especially when new gardeners come in, is the different vegetables that the Hmong farmers grow that many of us are not familiar with. And when you ask one of the Hmong farmers what that is, they may not have a name for it. So they compare something that looks like a cucumber, a traditional cucumber that we're familiar with, but it's not a traditional cucumber. And so we also get into cooking, and we get into community gatherings that really explore the culinary traditions, not just the different traditions in growing food. We talk about companion planting. So when I hear stories of gardening traditions with the families, eventually it leads to stories about the children and family. And obviously, we all realize that we have way more in common than we don't have in common. So it's a beautiful place to be grounded, not just in farming and food, but also in understanding who really occupies and lives in the city of Milwaukee.
When people start talking about these food traditions, do you get a sense of pride that maybe they didn't know was there as they realize their food heritage?
Without a doubt. I think more importantly, what happens is people see one another fully as the human beings that we are. And so whether we're talking about the Burmese refugees who are some of the new members of the Milwaukee community, or some of our sisters and brothers who have come in from different parts of Africa, when people really start to interweave their lives through food and through the growing of food, community is built in a powerful way that you cannot turn back from that. I will often hear people say that when they come to Alice's Garden, it's like walking into a piece of Eden. and if the Milwaukee community outside of the fence could represent what is felt inside the fence of Alice's Garden, this city and most cities would be a wonderful place to be.
Let's talk about that. Are you trying to plant the seed of this idea elsewhere in Milwaukee and beyond?
It is wonderful that the urban agriculture community in Milwaukee is very well connected, and there are so many of us who are on the ground, no pun intended, doing this work, building gardens, helping to build community. What I like to really push and stress with my colleagues is it has to be about more than planting physical seeds and planting plants. It really has to be about planting programs and impacting the quality of life for the residents if it's just on that block or in that four-block radius. So community gardens present an opportunity for us to really go deeply into the lives of the community, and we just use food as that entree into their lives.
How about younger people? Do a lot of youth participate in this, and what do you think they're getting out of it?
Without a doubt, I can speak for Alice's Garden and say this summer we engaged more than 30 young people on a daily basis in the growing of food, representing four, five different organizations in the city of Milwaukee. And so young people tend to be more open and not as set in their ways when it comes to being introduced to something new and different. So we have programs such as the Healthy Corner Store Initiative that my husband actually runs in the garden that hires young people from the community, and they grow food for local corner stores. We have organizations such as New Life and Urban Underground and Running Rebels who all are part of Alice's Garden, reintroducing young people to some of the traditions that their ancestors had and must be joyous that we are reclaiming.
And are they joyous? Do they, apart from the food itself, do they hear the stories that, that the other gardeners are telling and get a sense of who they are, where they came from, what is still there to overcome?
It is an intentional part of what we do. Our Earn and Learn program is called Garden Mosaics, and Garden Mosaics is a curriculum that was developed out of Cornell University that is all about people, plants, and culture. And so in that particular program, it involves the interviewing of the elders. There's a whole curriculum that's built around getting to know the food traditions of everyone who is present in the garden. So we are very intentional about the intergenerational and multi-generational learning that happens at Alice's Garden.
Venus, what in your life made you take on this and make it such a big part of your life?
There are so many different ways to answer that question, and we have like a minute left. I will say that the first garden that I can recall is that of my Choctaw great-grandmother and my African great-grandfather, Nellie and Henry Hoots. I remember that garden because I was scolded always for running through the corn.
Uh-oh.
But I also remember that kitchen and all the food that was taken from that garden into that kitchen. My grandmothers both have had gardens that I helped be a part of. And my mother still has her garden. And so urban gardening, although we like to think of it as something new, it really isn't anything new. It is something that some of us really grew up with. But had you told me back then that I would become an urban farmer, I would have laughed at you. So the seed was planted a long, long time ago.
Venus, thanks for being with us. That was Venus Williams, director of Alice's Garden in Milwaukee, author of a piece for Edible Milwaukee called Preserving the Culture in Urban Agriculture. Coming up, Thanksgiving kicks off, well, the holiday shopping season, but it's also the traditional kickoff for the seasonal giving time. A lot of people making their donations, year-end donations, in fact. Our next guest has lots of advice. She's a philanthropy expert. She'll tell us how we can combine our shopping and our giving and how to give to help with hunger, not just around the holidays, but around the year. Stick around. We've got that and more coming up on this Thanksgiving edition of Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert's off today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back.